From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Of Republican government, the English philosopher Herbert Spencer wrote that it's the highest form of government, but because of this, it requires the highest type of human nature, a type nowhere at present existing. Herbert Spencer wrote those words in the 19th century, at a time when Victorian English intellectuals were posing questions about the connections between human nature and forms of government that were peculiar to the times. But in the 1980s, similar inquiries persist. How have modern forms of republican government evolved from their origins in antiquity, particularly the republican city-states of ancient Greece? That question forms the basis for the following two-part Soundings discussion about republics, ancient and modern. The panelists for Soundings are Paul Ray, Mark Plattner, and George Kennedy. Paul Ray and Mark Plattner recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Paul Ray is a professor of classics at the University of Tulsa, currently on leave as a scholar in residence at the American Research Institute in Ankara, Turkey. Mark Plattner served as an advisor to the U.S. mission to the United Nations. George Kennedy is a professor of classics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Republics, ancient and modern. Here is Paul Ray.
At the turn of the century, there was an Irish-American journalist named Finley Peter Dunn who wrote a column of political and social satire for a Chicago newspaper. On one occasion, he touched on the ancient world, attributing the following observation to his character, the sage of Halsted Street, Mr. Dooley. "I know history isn't true, Hennessy, because it ain't like what I see every day in Halsted Street. If anyone comes along with the history of Greece or Rome, it'll show me the people fighting, getting drunk, making love, getting married, owing the grocery man and being without hard coal. I believe they was a Greece or Rome, but not before. Historians is like doctors, they're always looking for symptoms. Those of them that writes about their own times, examines the tongue and feels the pulse and makes a wrong diagnosis. The other kind of history is a post-mortem examination. It tells you what a country died of, but I'd like to know what it lived of."
So you're a social historian. You want to know, you want to get down onto the streets themselves and find out what actually happened in these ancient republics, how people lived. Is that right?
Sort of. I would say that if one wanted to study the ancient republics, though, and one wanted to ask how people lived and what they lived for, one would have to be a political historian.
Uh-huh.
And I think one of the great chasms between ancient republics and modern republics is the fact that ancient republics existed to make politics possible, to make the opportunities for glory and ambition possible, while modern republics exist explicitly to protect life, liberty, and property, or life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And pursuit of happiness means primarily property.
Well, let's pause on politics. Maybe we could use that as a focal point in our conversation for a few minutes. Paul Ray, let me ask you to comment. Was it a transfer, again, to generalize from then to now in terms of these political institutions, or were the so-called founding fathers, were they pretty selective about what they wanted to, were they picky? In what they took from antiquity and moved into 18th century America.
They were highly picky and highly choosy. What I would say, though, is that during the Revolutionary War, they are particularly attracted to the ancient models. And there's good reason for this. The American Republic is the first modern republic. Hmm. It's quite consciously created. And the problem they face is this. Before 1776, the majority of the founding fathers were Whigs, which is to say that they were the supporters of mixed monarchy. They were not Republicans. They found themselves becoming Republicans willy-nilly in the course of rebelling against both the British Crown and the British Parliament. They then faced the problem of creating a republic, and they looked around for models. Their initial reaction was to turn to the ancient models, which were the models. But they found gradually that through experience and through thinking through these things, that the ancient models didn't fit modern circumstances very well. Mm-hmm. And they not only found that, they also found that there were aspects of ancient republicanism that horrified them, in particular slavery. And the notion of dominion, the orientation of the ancient republics, Sparta and Rome were the republics that they admired, toward conquest and dominion. In reacting to this, they began to attempt, quite consciously, to establish a new kind of republic.
The question for Mark Plattner that you might want to consider. Paul Ray has said that the founding fathers, quote unquote, looked back and were selective in what they brought into the evolution of American republicanism. Did they do that because it was good, that is to say, the models that they were looking at in antiquity, or was it simply all that they knew?
Well, I guess I would put my answer this way, that they begin with the fact that they want a wholly republican government. This is the only kind of government that would be acceptable to the American people. But beyond that, I would say that their view of the ancient republics, apart from the fact that they're republics, is largely negative. Let me just read a sentence or two to you from Federalist Paper number 9, which was written by Hamilton. Quote, "It is impossible to read the history of the petty republics of Greece and Italy without feeling sensations of horror and disgust at the distractions with which they were continually agitated, and at the rapid succession of revolutions by which they were kept in a state of perpetual vibration between the extremes of tyranny and anarchy." And later in the same number, The Federalist, Hamilton writes, "If it had been found impracticable to have devised models of a more perfect structure, the enlightened friends to liberty would have been obliged to abandon the cause of that species of government, that is, republican government, as indefensible." So I think, in a sense, the ancient republics were more cautionary models than positive models for the founders. Sure. And the crucial point for them was to find a new form of republican government, new sorts of republican institutions that would preserve private liberty, that is, the liberty of the private person, in a way that the ancient republics did not.
Comment from George Kennedy.
I think there were are two reasons why they turned to ancient models, and I agree that they criticize and distrusted these ancient models, as Mark has said. One is that they perceived antiquity as the only, at least only documented, previous experience with a republican government. But the other is a somewhat more general cultural bias, if you will, and arises from the nature of formal education in the 18th century, which was so centered on classical subjects. Latin dominated the formal curriculum. Most of the founding fathers had some study of Greek also, and the kinds of things that one studies, in, say, in a modern university with a great diversity of fields across the social and natural sciences, in large part did not exist in 18th century education. Thus, they were, by their formal training, inclined to look at antiquity as the model of literary excellence, of excellence in the arts, and also of political knowledge. And one sees, of course, this same kind of influence in 18th century architecture in the United States Capitol, if you will, and in the literature of the 18th century, its uses of mythology, its imitation of classical models, which Americans did as well as Europeans.
We talk about politics in America in the 1980s, and the politicians tell us, "I want to improve your life. I want to make the quality of your life, individual citizens, good. I want you to live better than Grandpa and Grandma did," that sort of thing. Is there any kind of parallel with that sort of political discourse in the ancient world? Again, I'm asking you about, apart from war and peace, what were some of the things that the politicians would talk to the citizens about? Paul, Ray, you want?
One finds something of this rhetoric in antiquity, but the interesting thing is not that you will live better and be more prosperous. It's that you will be better men than your ancestors, or that you will live up to their example.
Talking about character now.
For example, Aristophanes is continually emphasizing the standard that is set by the Marathonomachoi, the men who fought at Marathon. And when in the Frogs he is judging poetry, whether Aeschylus is the better poet, or whether Euripides is the better poet, The standard of judgment is, what kind of men do these poets produce? So similarly, when you're judging a political regime, and this is evident, for example, in Pericles' funeral oration, the standard for judging a political regime is whether it produces men who are capable of conquering and exercising dominion. His standard is the same as that of the Spartans, though his regime that he's praising is very different from that of the Spartans. And he suggests that Athens, which is a freer society than ancient Sparta, is a better society, not because it's freer, but because it produces better men. And the ultimate standard of quality is courage on the battlefield, and of course, intelligence and deliberation. A combination of words and deeds.
This is also, isn't it, Paul, a point of Plato. Socrates is made to evaluate 5th century statesmen on the basis of answering the question, did they make the people better or did they make the people worse?
He even goes farther, George. He also raises the question of, did they make their own sons better or they make their own sons worse?
How many modern statesmen, politicians would like to be evaluated on the basis of their sons?
It would be a great embarrassment.
How about commercial issues, commerce? Did politics affect discourse about commerce, about materiality, that kind of thing? Mark?
Let me respond to your earlier question about whether ancient politicians promised that things would get better in an economic way. I think that question really reflects a very modern view of the possibility and indeed an almost inevitable expectation that there will be economic growth, that because of technological progress and other factors that each generation will enjoy a greater quantity of material things than the previous generation. I think that is a very characteristically modern view that would not have been felt in any way in the ancient world or in the pre-modern world generally.
Well, people simply weren't, I don't mean to say preoccupied, the emphasis was not on the material and the commercial, is that right?
I suppose one could say there was less emphasis, but also the nature of, you didn't have a dynamic economy in the same way, and the technological progress being applied to economic growth.
Did the economies depend on martial issues? Is that what it all came down to? Paul?
I'd say yes. If you want to improve your prosperity over against the prosperity of your fathers, you go out and conquer a territory. And either take the land, or more likely what you do is you take the inhabitants of that territory, either sell them into slavery or enslave them and use them on your own farms. So that was one dimension of it. In other words, the economy, if you will, was absorbed into politics, and war was placed at the center of politics. If, however, you look at the modern republic, the interesting thing is that distinguishes the American Republic from everything that came before is the fact that in the Constitution there is a clause guaranteeing patents. The American regime is explicitly based on the notion of dynamic technology and on the deliberate promotion of dynamic technology. Now, there's nothing like that in the ancient world except in one case. We have one anecdote about a city that did have a patent law. It was the city of Sybaris in southern Italy, from which our word sybaritic comes, meaning decadent and luxurious. Sybaris, we are told, had a law that if you dreamed up something new in a particular field of endeavor, you would have a monopoly right to produce that something new for 1 year. Now, the interesting thing is that the field of endeavor was cooking, which is to say that the ancient view is that this notion of innovation being a good thing is tied up with becoming fat and weak and decadent.
They wanted to stay mean and lean. Is that
For
right?
example, the last paragraph of Herodotus' history raises the question about whether a conquering people should leave their homeland and move to a better climate where it's easier to produce food and where it's easier to live in general. The response that Herodotus puts in the mouth of the king of Persia, which happens to be this country, is soft countries make soft men. And he advises against doing it. The last word of Herodotus' histories is the word duluein, which means to be enslaved. To live in a soft country is to become a soft man, is ultimately to be enslaved. If you are to be free, you must be tough. I remember running across a book not too long ago called The Courage to be Free, which was a book about moral questions. Well, in antiquity, it took courage to be free politically, and therefore courage was the principal civil virtue. What I would suggest is this, that the energies that in antiquity went into politics and war go into technology and commerce today. And that channeling of energies is peculiar to the modern republic. James Madison, when he talks about what modern republics are all about, talks about the regulation of commerce and property. Those will be the central issues, not peace and war. These republics will, on the whole, be pacific, at least in their relations with one another. But there is a kind of conquering instinct, and that conquering instinct is reflected in the patent law. What we are to conquer is nature. What we are to do is to transform our environment. And the effect of that means that we are culturally, if you will, imperialistic, which is to say, in transforming our environment, we not only transform the environment in which we as Americans live, the first modern Republicans, we also transform the environment in which the other nations live. Because, among other things, technology has implications for war.
Paul, do you think there's a sense in which politics in Greece was a form of play? We've mentioned the basis of ancient economy in slave owning. That and such things as the establishment of the Athenian Empire, the tribute or income of which made it possible for the Athenians to abolish taxation upon themselves, created an opening whereby the citizens vied with one another in a process of asserting their own influence, power against others, all of which was essentially a game that filled a void made possible by the economic basis of slavery or enslavement of others. Would you agree with that?
Sure. I think politics always has an element of the playful in it. And in antiquity, it was a game, all right, but it was a very serious game.
Oh,
because
yes.
What was at stake was not only justice and one's own view of what justice was, but also survival.
Is politics a game in anything like the same sense in a modern democracy? Political, our national elections in particular, take on the form of a form of public entertainment, do they not? In which the audience sometimes gets bored and walks out, but where the whole thing is dramatized into the circuses of national conventions and the like.
Well, one way you can see that is the way the network news treats the primaries or the general election. They treat them as if they're horse races. And in fact, the horse race metaphor gets used constantly in this regard. And it's because they're in the entertainment industry. And in fact, I would say that television has made a great game out of it. Though in truth, if you look at the 19th century, when people traveled around giving speeches at the Chautauqua circuit, etc., it was clearly very much a form of public entertainment. And I think so in antiquity as well. I mean, there's a reference to that Cleon makes in a speech in Thucydides, in which he accuses the Athenians of being spectators of speeches and of taking delight in innovations in speeches. So that it's clear that they were acutely aware that part of what these meetings were for was to show them a good time.
Mark Plattner.
Yes, I would like to perhaps change the emphasis in what we've been discussing or bring it back to the fact that for the ancients, politics was the most serious business in a sense that it was the only activity apart perhaps from philosophy that was considered truly worthy of a free man, in particular that the ancients regarded commercial activity as unworthy of a free man. And I think there, again, you have a great contrast with modern times where the serious business of life is business. And in a way, our politics revolve around economic issues. And to the extent that people don't view it as a game, it's often because their own economic interests are very clearly at stake. Whether an industry will thrive or will suffer from foreign competition, those matters are regarded in deadly earnest by people.
Following up what Mark Plattner has just said, Mark Plattner, Paul Ray, George Kennedy, you were discussing republics, ancient and modern, and you have been discussing the various emphases on the martial and the commercial, even the psychological. Paul Ray pointed out that in these ancient republics, the aim of politics was individual betterment. Tell me about human nature. How did the ancients look at human nature in their views of republics? How do those views compare or differ with our notions today? Big order.
Xenophon, in a dialogue called The Hero, attributes to one of his characters, Simonides, the opinion that what distinguishes man from the animals is the love of honor. And he makes it very specific that it's tied up with the fact that man has speech. Sometime later, Aristotle says man is by nature a political animal. That's what distinguishes him from the other animals. And he says that what that means is that he has speech. He can discuss the difference between good and evil, just and unjust, the advantageous and the disadvantageous. In a conversation reported by Boswell in The Life of Johnson, Benjamin Franklin is supposed to have said that man is by nature a tool-making animal. Now, what I'd suggest is that there really is a very different conception of the nature of man that lies behind ancient republicanism and modern republicanism. If you look at the Federalist, and if you look at the most important document in the Federalist, Madison's Federalist Number 10, he says that the first object of government is the protection of the faculties of men for acquiring property. That's tied up with the notion that man is a tool-making animal. He's an animal that comes to dominate nature. He's an animal that acquires by mixing his labor, his efforts to conquer nature, with that particular thing in nature, and therefore takes possession of it. So in a certain sense, man is an acquisitive or a possessive animal, as understood by the moderns. While for the ancients, man is a talking animal. He is a speaking animal. He is an animal that craves not property as much as he craves honor. And he one of the aspects of this craving of honor is the desire to make his own opinions, to impose his own opinions on other people. However, there's one other aspect about the moderns that's worth noting, and that is there's a kind of bifurcation. What I said about man being a tool-making animal would fit Hobbes perfectly. Mm-hmm. And what Hobbes tries to do is do away with politics. You create a sovereign, and the sovereign takes care of these things, and he protects men, and he protects their labor, and he protects their property. In the American Republic, the regime does all of those things, but it also opens a kind of ground for ambition. So the American Republic seems to me to be based on the notion that man is first a tool-making animal, but he's also a speaking animal. He's also an animal that craves honor. And that's tied up with the notion that men are somewhat political. Hmm. And I think the American people reflect this. And you can see that in last year's primary season or even earlier primary seasons. At virtually any time when a candidate seems to have locked it up, the people of a given state vote against him. And they vote against him because they do not want to be deprived of a choice. All of which is to say that one of the things that's fundamental to American life is the pride of the American people and the fact that their sense of dignity is bound up with having a choice.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the first segment in a two-part discussion about republics, ancient and modern. The Soundings panelists are Paul Ray of the University of Tulsa, Mark Plattner, formerly an advisor to the U.S. mission to the United Nations, and George Kennedy of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Paul Ray and Mark Plattner have completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Part two of the discussion follows next week on Soundings. The first segment of Republics, Ancient and Modern, concludes now with comments about a new book on that topic, recently published by the historian Barbara Tuchman. The title of Barbara Tuchman's new book is The March of Folly. Here with comments about it is Robert Ginger, book critic for the Greensboro, North Carolina News and Record.
Wooden-headedness, writes distinguished historian Barbara Tuchman, plays a remarkably large role in government. That governments stoop to folly doesn't come as a surprise. But the fact that the author of The Guns of August, Stillwell and the American Experience in China, and A Distant Mirror, would want to examine so vast and fuzzy a phenomenon, well, that's intriguing. Here Mrs. Tuckman examines the collective blindness that led the Trojans to take the wooden horse inside their walls, the Renaissance popes to bring about the Protestant secession, the British to lose America, and America to betray herself in Vietnam. The ruse of the Trojan horse becomes for Mrs. Tuckman the prototype for collective folly. Why, despite Laocoon's warning, either the Greeks are hiding in this monster, or it's some trick of war, a spy or engine, and Cassandra's prophecies, did the Trojans elect to take the gift inside their walled city? In one version of Virgil's Aeneid, the wooden horse is so large that the Trojans must remove the lintel of their Scaean gate to let in the machine of their annihilation. The architecture of civilization is full of such broken lintels. Why do governments perversely pursue policies destructive to their own best interests? Mrs. Tuckman's indelible examples illustrate that governments repeatedly lay the footings for hopeless enterprises, even when at first blush they promise to be disasters. Roosevelt, for example, was reluctant to support the French in Indochina because of their shabby exploitative record there. But de Gaulle's consequent tantrum, his primitive blackmail, "We do not want to become communists, but I hope you do not push us into it," helped to set the stage for European and American attrition in Vietnam, not to mention the horror. Barbara Tuckman's uncanny ability to resurrect the past and to rove over history with intimate ease distinguishes the book. But in another important sense, the book fails. The March of Folly promises more than it delivers. Mrs. Tuckman seems here to be satisfied to cite examples of government's folly, but not particularly keen on exploring that broad subject. The coherent and spirited inquiry of The Guns of August, for example, is missing. The casual brilliance is not. Thus Tuckman introduces a profound definition with unstudied elegance. At about the time Columbus discovered America, the Renaissance, which is to say the period when the values of this world replaced those of the hereafter, was in full flower in Italy. Fascinating are her studies of the avarice and depravity of some of the Renaissance popes, and of how their catastrophic complacency paved the way for Martin Luther and the Reformation. But don't look for reasons behind their addiction to the counterproductive, or for larger historical implications. What of our 20th century addiction? Bent upon an enterprise of suicidal folly, Mrs. Tuckman argues, we invest all our skills and resources in a conquest for armed superiority. Until we learn to expend rational energy toward mutual divestment of the means of human suicide, the lemming instinct among governments would seem hardier and more durable than ever.
Robert Ginger is book critic for the Greensboro, North Carolina News and Record. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. You've been listening to the first segment in a two-part discussion about republics, ancient and modern. Next week on Soundings, part two of the conversation, featuring Paul Ray of the University of Tulsa, Mark Plattner, formerly a member of the U.S. delegation to the United Nations, and George Kennedy of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.